When we last left you, the global stage was gripped by the tensions of an impending regional war. Though we all hoped that Iran's response would bring closure to the struggle, it was evident that Israel had other plans. Earlier this week, Iran intercepted an Israeli missile strike. Now, tidings of war seem unclear. Before we start directly with speaking about the possibility of war, we should probably take a look at some of the key players. Who are the so-called axis of resistance, and what have they done over the past 6 months since October 7th?
Hi, Alejandro. Hi, everyone. So the Axis of Resistance is a coalition of state and non-state actors that cooperate to act as a deterrent to perceived threats from the U.S. and Israel, essentially. And this isn't something that's unheard of. For example, NATO essentially exists as the same thing. They act as a deterrent. You mess with one of them, you mess with all of them, essentially. So that is the same thing with the Axis of Resistance. And I think we've heard in the past, George Bush famously called them the Axis of Evil. But of course, that's how the West wants to frame them. So the key members, in the Gaza Strip, we have Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is the closest of them to Iran. Then in Iraq, we have the Iraqi Shiite militias that coordinate as well. In Lebanon, we have Hezbollah. In Syria, we have the Syrian state and pro-government militias, which in terms of state actors that are in this coalition, Syria is one of the state actors. And then in Yemen, the Houthi rebels. We've seen them very active in this confrontation with Israel. So when it comes to these key members in this coalition, basically their strategic aims broadly align. So they share the same goals. Maybe their approach might be different, but essentially they share the same goals. That means the level of influence from Iran varies. And it's not like coercion or anything. They actually, like I said, they share the same goals. So naturally they came together to serve that purpose.
Yeah, that's an important point to make. We need to distinguish that they do not exist for Iran per se. They, as you said, they have their own ambitions, their own aims, often national. And because these align with the aims of other groups, they naturally form alliances. They're allies, they're not part of the same thing, basically. They're not controlled by Iran, they act independently. But I guess the question is why they support Palestine in the first place, and specifically Iran, which is the biggest power of all of the Axis of Resistance. And I guess we need to go back a bit into history to the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. Before the revolution was a monarchy, it was seen as a puppet to Western interests, and it was a very repressive state in itself. And so, I mean, let's not go into the Iranian Revolution, because that's a very complex topic and with lots of differing opinions, and that's not what we're here for today. The main thing is that we now recognize that we went from a state which was not really aligned with Israel nor Palestine to a state which was inherently, from the get-go, very pro-Palestinian, because the revolution aimed to bring in this very anti-imperialist ambitions. And so I guess if we sort of bring this into the context of their strategic aims and everything, Iran, and I mean, we should mention this from the start, Iran and Hezbollah and all of these other groups, they don't act for Palestinians from the kindness of their hearts. They have their own ambitions. And with Iran, it's the exact same. They blame Western sanctions for their own society's ills, and they kind of want to create a cushion, a shield around them for protection, because the threat of Israel is still there. Israel has, from the beginning of the revolutions, seeked to destroy the revolution and seek to end this anti-Zionist sentiment within Iran. And with Hezbollah in Lebanon, they were created after the 1982 invasion of Lebanon by the Israelis. And so they were their own resistance group within Lebanon. They didn't arise from Palestinians in Lebanon. They arose from Lebanese people who were tired of the Israeli occupation and tired of the war, and came to take matters into their own hands. Now they are also a political party, and so they have their own domestic ambitions. Again, this is more reason to believe that they are not just satellite states of Iran, and that they just have this strategic aim to destroy Israel for the sake of it. They have their own ambitions, and they support Palestinians because they have those aligned interests.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they realize that Israel is this destabilizing entity in the, you know, the heart of the Middle East. And it is a sort of Western encroachment, right? So I don't want to say it like this, but essentially Israel slash Palestine is going to be this proxy between, you know, the proxy for the West, namely Israel would be for the West, and then Palestine being the proxy for the East. We're going to see this larger geopolitical thing play out in the future, I think. But go ahead.
I just want to touch on the word they use, proxies, because, I mean, we've already said they're allies. They're not part of the same organization. However, they do work together through sending each other arms and sending each other support. And, well, in the case now, in the last 6 months, we've seen Hezbollah in Lebanon trade fire with the Israelis, although it should be said that a lot of these attacks going across the borders come from the Israeli side onto the Lebanese side. This is an Israeli aggression into Lebanon as well.
You know, and people often ask, why, what's the stated aim for Israel? Why do they keep, you know, basically inciting? They're provoking, right? You see this constantly. What they did with the Iranian embassy in Syria was actually a violation of war. And that gave every right for Iran to respond. So why I realized that things were going to be contained, because it was almost like an enumerated right. I don't want to say it like that, but, you know, it's almost like everyone stand back, you know, Iran gets to do this now.
But I guess that's everything that really needs to be said now on that part, on the background of who these groups are. Let's now look a bit at whether war will happen. I mean, we've seen the Iranian retaliation, which we spoke about last week on the podcast. And now we saw a few days later, the Israelis sent their own response. Now, this response was, personally, I thought it would be a lot bigger. I thought they would really go all guns blazing. But they decided to keep it a bit more contained. It was an attack which targeted an Iranian military airbase belonging to the IRGC. We spoke a tiny bit about that last week. The attack was nullified by the Iranian air defense systems, and so there was no actual damage or casualties reported. It should be said that this response by the Israelis could be seen in a similar context as we saw last week with Iran, where it was more to see exactly how the Iranian air defense system works, exactly how these things work together, so that in the future, and it was also a statement, it was to show we can also hit you from our territory, the Israelis would say. And so now if we look at it in the context of whether a larger regional war will occur, because it wasn't the aggressive response that many of us were thinking would happen, the possibility of war has maybe gone down slightly for now. However, these tensions will persist for as long as there's a genocide in Gaza going on, and for as long as Israel keeps acting in its brazen way that it has, attacking the Iranian embassy in Damascus, firing rockets across the border into Lebanon every day. The tensions won't go anywhere until all of this ends, and Israel has the power to do all of that. But now, Dee, I wanted to ask you, in the case of a wider war, how would it affect Palestinians and specifically Gazans who are having this genocide against them now?
You know, this is a loaded question because it's also something I have to imagine, right? The way I see it, if a larger war breaks out, it's going to pull Israel's attention away from Gaza, because now they're having, you know, confrontation on all fronts, from the north, from Iran, from the, you know, from the south, from the Houthis, Iraq. A full-scale war, Israel cannot take on its own. Israel is banking on the fact that if it goes into a full-scale regional war, the U.S. has to get involved. But the thing is, the U.S. is drawing back. They don't want that right now. So here's the thing. If war does break out, in terms of fighting, on-the-ground fighting in Gaza or any of that, if a regional war does break out, yeah, I think it would give, you know, Hamas and all these Palestinian militant groups in Gaza to kind of formulate an attack as well. But then again, like I said, Israel is going to be pulled in different directions of a multi-front war. Again, Gaza's still going to be in the state that it's in, right? When this war does break out, or if it does, I mean, they're still starving. They're still suffering, you know, destruction and death.
I was just going to add exactly that point, that the humanitarian catastrophe that's occurring will not change, because at the end of the day, Israel doesn't need... It could pull all of its troops out of Gaza, and it would still be able to control Gaza from outside, and it probably, due to the distraction of the wider war, wouldn't have as much pressure to allow aid into Gaza, and so people would still be going hungry and
exactly
well be getting hungrier.
Exactly. And imagine when war does break out, humanitarian operations are going to be halted because now that puts those personnel at risk. So again, they would suffer more. We don't know exactly how it would play out. Maybe the border in Egypt might open because of how bad things are getting. We don't know. We could only imagine how it would play out. And the problem is right now, obviously, we don't see the likelihood of war playing out because, you know, things were contained. But we've seen both actors assess each other's capabilities. Now they're sizing up each other, right, for a future conflict or confrontation. So it's likely in the future, maybe not now.
Absolutely. And I think, well, we can also add on to the point that a war between Iran and Israel will also devastate the Iranian population. It will devastate, if full-blown war comes onto the northern border with Lebanon as well, it will devastate the Lebanese population because, well, at the end of the day, the US has already said that they will come in to defend Israel. And we've seen that their air defense systems, together joined with France, the UK and Jordan, controversially, it is effective. However, we would have to see how it plays out when Iran really flexes its muscle.
I think I mentioned this before. I'm so sorry. I think I mentioned this before we came on the air. And this is the whole idea of what's publicly being displayed when it comes to war and then backdoor negotiations. People have to remember what we're seeing is not also happening behind closed doors. This is why I kind of figured things were going to be contained because, you know, I got word based on my career, we get global security notifications that there were negotiations happening behind closed doors. While everything was, you know, playing out for us to see, they were, hashing things out. And we got to remember this. There are negotiators and, you know, there is, diplomacy that's happening. We don't see it. We just see the military aggression. Moving forward, I think this is something we just need to consider. You know, things are being handled accordingly because no one wants to see war. It is devastating. It is destructive to all parties, not just both parties.
But I mean, let's touch on that point now exactly, because you said nobody really wants war in terms of the civilian populations everywhere. However, the reason for war to now really be a possibility comes from Israel alone, really. And I think proof of that is, or reasons for that, actually, to begin with, I think reasons for that come from their failures in Gaza. Hamas is still in charge of pretty much the entire Gaza Strip. Israel has spent 6 months attempting to remove Hamas, and they have failed miserably. Now it's a myth of Israeli invincibility is completely gone. Everybody, the axis of resistance, sees now that Israel is a lot weaker because of this failure, but also because of October in itself. And I think what's become very clear is Israel's over-reliance on US military support. And now I think we see this stroppy child not knowing how to act because Israel has always been given what it's wanted. And now it's realizing how powerless it actually is in the grand scheme of things in the entire region.
That's so important because, like you said, they revealed their weakness. Israel is essentially weak without the West backing them. And that's been revealed to essentially, you know, the regional powers, the regional opposition, which is Iran and all those other groups. Now they know that Israel cannot essentially exists on its own. It needs the full backing of the West, especially the US.
And as well, within the Israeli population, the Israeli public is incredibly divided. The situation was already fragile before October 7th, with Netanyahu trying to pass the judicial reforms within, which were deeply unpopular. And now, after October 7th, we just see this incredibly divided society again, divided in how best to kill Palestinians, it should be said.
I was going to say that. Thank you for correcting yourself.
Like 95%, I think I saw in a poll the other day, support this war, this genocide to continue. And a significant proportion of that 95% believe that not enough force has been dealt to Palestinians in Gaza, or as they see it, as to terrorists, because they all see all Palestinians as terrorists.
No, exactly. And this is so important because people are trying to put it on the Netanyahu government. No, no, no. This is a problem with Zionism. So this is, I mean, we see it amongst the society. We see it amongst Israeli society. People, I mean, you question, why is there such a right-wing government installed in Israel? Well, who voted them in? Who voted them in?
I think the point you made about it being a Zionist problem is incredibly important. It's the inherent issue at the bottom of this. But in terms of now, whether we get a regional war, I think it's really still all in the hands of Netanyahu because of his own deep unpopularity, because of his deteriorating relationship with Biden, because of his failures on October 7th, because he's, I mean, as I say this, I remember seeing there was a poll conducted recently that he's actually improved within Israeli society again. And now he's his numbers are increasing. And I mean, I say this to everyone, as he is really one of the most disgusting people to ever have stepped foot on this planet. But he is an incredibly smart politician because he has managed to somehow stay in power amid everything he has done.
Smart or just, I don't know. Here's the thing. He's behaving like a rabid dog. At least his government is. And we can see that. And that's what happens when your back is pushed against the wall. When you feel like you are facing this existential threat, you know, your entire entity is just going to crumble. The settler colonial project is about to fail. That we see that. I mean, that sentiment is coming out from them. They're reacting in such, you know, a barbaric and savage way that we know their fate is coming. They know that their fate is coming. And what happens to a rabid dog? It goes comatose and dies.
But I mean, in the context of Israel being at its weakest point, so to say, ever, that we've seen, at least for me, at least in my lifetime, we have spoken a bit about the elephant in the room, the guarantor of Israeli security, and that is the US. I guess we should probably touch a bit on the actual relationship between Israel and the US, because if there's anybody that would prevent anything happening to its little baby, it would be the US. So Dee, if you want to sort of touch a bit on this relationship, this special ironclad relationship that has been growing since Israel's inception, really.
So the US has supported Israel since its inception, which in 1948, President Harry Truman became the first world leader to recognize a Zionist entity. And this is moments after its creation. So then in the 60s, we had John F. Kennedy, and he was one of those presidents that challenged Israel. And he challenged Israel's nuclear development program. He challenged Israel's, at the time, was it AIPAC at the time? Anyways, he wanted the Israel lobby group to register as a foreign agent under FARA. So then you have the 80s and 90s. It was the support between the U.S. and Israel has stayed consistent since, 80s onwards. We've seen this relentless support from the U.S., unconditional support, pretty much up until now. Up until now, we're seeing something different. We're seeing a little bit more of...
I was just going to say that this support has grown from the 80s specifically because the Iranian Revolution in 1979 occurred, and that's when the tide started to turn in the Middle East and this anti-American sentiment began to grow.
That's true. You actually touched on that earlier. And, you made me think of that one video of Biden. I think it was actually from the 80s when he was like, if Israel didn't exist, we would have to go in and create one. Because exactly, Israel is that extension of the West. Okay, so now let's talk about the current relationship between the U.S. and Israel, because this is where things are starting to change since the 80s. You know, we know that Israel receives $3.8 billion in military aid from the U.S., annually, and this is under the most recent memorandum signed in 2019. That's 16% of Israel's total military budget in 2022. Bilateral annual trade of nearly $50 billion in goods and services. So we're not only talking about, military trade, we're talking about goods and services as well. Israel is now the 10th largest military exporter in the world, now making the U.S. conversely rely on Israel. In terms of weapons export, Israel, I think, is like... don't quote me. It's in the top five, I want to say. I mean, think about it. Israel has that ability to test weapons on a population it is oppressing and imprisoning. And it tests on Palestinians, and then it markets it based on the success rate from, testing on Palestinians. It's crazy to me. So they have that advantage in that market, in the weapons market. And then we have Biden's unwavering support. We've seen this, right? We've seen Biden relentlessly support Israel.
As much as Biden is a massive supporter of Israel, though, he has stated recently in the last few weeks that the US wouldn't support a war with Iran, or at least it wouldn't support an attack on Iran by Israel. What does that mean? It means that in the case of Iran retaliating again, it would step in its defense, but it would not take an active role in bombing Iran directly, whether from Israel or from anywhere. It wouldn't participate in any attack. But what also came out recently was the ultimatum, I guess, that Netanyahu gave Biden, the option to either strike Iran or to invade Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, where there's now around 1.5 million Palestinian refugees in an area where usually under 200,000 people would be living. This, again, just shows the level of barbarity. I mean, it's, can we kill this country's civilians or can we kill this country's civilians? And the US didn't decide to step up and say, maybe we shouldn't kill civilians. Instead, it said, you can kill Palestinian civilians. And so one of the effects that we should see of all of this is that for now, there might not be a regional war because Israel has now been given the green light to invade Rafah and as a result, kill Palestinian civilians. But I guess in this context, I mean, we've been speaking this entire episode about what would happen if regional war would happen. We're presuming now that something will happen, whether now or next year, like it could happen at any point. The tensions will not go away until there's a real solution to this. And so I guess the question is here, how can a war really look and how would winning actually look like for either side?
These questions are so loaded just because, again, you have to imagine something that's not quite happening yet. And, you know, to imagine a reality based on what we see, based on the current reality, here's the thing. I've always thought if there were a war to play out, it wouldn't be between state actors. It would be between, yes, there would be state actors, but I think the axis of resistance, which we, as I stated previously, are mostly non-state actors, the Hizb, the Houthis, the Iraqi Shiite militias, the Syrian government, or affiliated to the Syrian government militias. So these are all non-state actors. So what happens in this particular case is these non-state actors allow for plausible deniability for state actors, meaning if they attack, let's say they attack Israel or some U.S. military base, okay, nearby. It's easy for a state to be, you know, to say our hands are clean, that wasn't us. Therefore, it's not an act of war between states. It becomes between a non-state actor and a state actor. Do you get that? It gives that plausible deniability to states. I've always said it was going to be a confrontation between, you know, these non-state actors and state actors from the West. So I never imagined a full-scale regional war. And we've seen that today. I mean, we see that currently, like no one's really willing to go all in and start a war, a regional war. Everyone's doing it, but acting with restraint. You know, they're just doing almost like the tit for tat thing. You bomb me, now I get to bomb you. So, you know, stand down and don't do anything else.
And I think that's well within the preference of the axis of resistance, because they do know that if the US gets involved, they will be the weaker side. And generally, Israel is a nuclear power, and so they really have to be careful. And I think we've touched on it a few times within this episode. They are engaged in a war of attrition. They know that over time, they will be more effective in dealing little blows to Israel than if they go out for a full blown out war.
I mean, that is deterrence, though, right? That's how they deter Israel from, you know, going full scale on them, right? And like I said, they were assessing each other's capabilities and trying to see what you have and what I have and what you can do and what I can do, how far you can reach, how far I can reach. All of that is just sizing up the other for probably a future confrontation. Who knows?
Up until now, that being the strategy of the axis of resistance means that when we look at the context of war, the two sides have different aims. The mm-hmm. sides, and specifically now, if we look at Hamas in the Gaza Strip, them simply staying alive and staying as an organization and staying in control of the Gaza Strip means that they win. And so it's very difficult for them to lose. Israel is already at a disadvantage in that sense. However, if we then go into a full regional war, I mean, both sides would be trying to wipe each other off the map, or at least in the case of Israel to Iran, they would be attempting to remove this Islamic Republic and replace it with something which would be more friendly to them, as we saw in the past with the monarchy that existed before.
Yeah. The thing is, like you said, when each is facing that existential threat, then everyone's going to start going hard. My thing is like you said, no one's really trying to eliminate the other completely. They're trying to dismantle Zionism. At least that's what Iran's trying to do, right? And, you know, the Western influence and encroachment is a problem. And, you know, don't do that. Basically, don't get involved. You know, keep your hands out of here.
But I mean, I guess the key point up until then is that we find ourselves really in a status quo, a new status quo regarding Palestinians and specifically people in Gaza, whereby they are slowly being forgotten on the international stage because of these growing tensions. These tensions won't go away even if they start to go down. But at the end of the day, the same reality exists for Gazans. And that's fine with the rest of the world, apparently. They don't care for Palestinian lives. They don't care for Gazan lives. And as always, we need to keep the pressure up on our elected officials here. And if you live in Europe or in the US, we need to keep the pressure up and we need to actively be doing things, educating others, spreading awareness, taking part in boycotting, doing anything you can so that we can really pressure our government to put pressure on Israel to end this genocide. But on that note, do you have anything else left to say, Dee?
I think I'm all talked out today.
Well, on that note, I guess we want to thank you for listening again, making it this far in the episode, and we'll see you again soon.